Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Procrastination.
Can't believe you put it off until today, and then we couldn't do anything because Elaine runs out to apologize to a virgin, crosses against a light, knocks over Chinese delivery boy.
One of the greatest labor-saving inventions of today is tomorrow.
Procrastination is the art of keeping up with yesterday.
Let's get some Chinese. You want to order?
All right, but then we got to get some work done.
If it weren't for the last minute, I wouldn't get anything done.
The sooner I fall behind, the more time I have to catch up.
Come on, let's get it together.
All right, you know what we should do? We should go to the movies.
Anyone can do any amount of work, provided it isn't the work he's supposed to be doing at that moment.
All right, let's just get to work. Bix? What'd you get, Bix?
Well, you got a problem with the pen now.
Our guest is Timothy Pitchell, director of the Procrastination Research Group at Carleton University.
Only Robinson Crusoe had everything done by Friday.
Procrastination. Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Oh, let's decide that tomorrow.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the studios of KALW San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus.
Today, procrastination.
It's a topic we've been putting off for quite a while. Ha ha
ha. That's a pretty obvious one, John. Now, John, everyone who knows you realizes that you are actually an expert practitioner of the procrastinating arts, and also that you've written a series of lovely essays on the topic.
Why, thank you, Ken. I certainly have. And my essay, Structured Procrastination, I think is the most read thing I've ever written. By the way, listeners can find it at structuredprocrastination.com.
So that makes you an expert on procrastination, both from an experiential and from a theoretical point of view.
Not really, Ken. My essay is a very short, somewhat tongue-in-cheek essay that is designed to make procrastinators feel better about themselves. I'm really good at that. But there are real experts on procrastination. One of the finest, Timothy Pitchell, who's director of the Procrastination Research Group at Carleton University, will join us in a bit. Now, he's a psychologist who's done research on why we procrastinate and also what the best methods are for dealing with it.
You know, he's a psychologist, and we're philosophers, so that leads to the question, why is procrastination a philosophical issue or problem?
Well, since the time of the Greeks, philosophers, at least some of them, have been puzzled by how we decide that something is the best thing to do, and then we don't do it. And procrastination is an example of that. For example, I decide the best thing to do, all things considered, is to get up from the couch, go to my desk, and grade some term papers. But instead of doing that, I lie on the couch and watch a rerun of Cheers for the fourth time.
But that's just laziness. Is there really a philosophical problem about laziness, what laziness is?
Well, maybe I finally get up, but instead of grading the papers, I start cleaning up the kitchen. Then I move on to cleaning up the garage. I'm not being lazy. I'm just not doing what I've decided it's best for me to do. That's procrastination, not laziness.
Well, okay, so procrastination isn't laziness, at least not mere laziness, but it is a form of irrationality, I think. And is that so mysterious? People are irrational in lots of ways, and in some ways, thank goodness, because without irrationality, we philosophers wouldn't have much work to do.
Well, but if so, it's a very peculiar form of irrationality. Let me give you an analogy. Suppose you're multiplying 7 times 5 and adding 10. So you carefully figure out 7 times 5 is 35, add 10, and you have 45. And then you write down 55.
Well, but maybe that's just a slip of a pen. You don't really realize what you're doing.
Well, it wouldn't be mysterious if it was a slip of the pen, but suppose you're very aware that the right answer is 45. It's the best answer to write down, but you intentionally, purposefully, deliberately, and carefully write down 55. That's peculiar, right?
Very peculiar. Very, very peculiar.
Well, procrastination seems a little bit like that. You figure out what's best to do, most important to do, the rational thing to do, the right answer to the question, what should I be doing? And then you do something else.
Well, that certainly is puzzling. It's very puzzling. People call that clear-eyed procrastination. You're looking the best in the eye, right in the face, and you do the not best. And that's really puzzling. Now, to really be puzzled by that, you need a certain picture of the will, that is, of how we decide what to do. It's like what you say, kind of transposed to the will. The picture is that deliberating is like figuring out the answer to a problem, the problem, in this case, of what to do. And acting is just drawing the conclusion, like writing down the answer in your analogy. If that was the right picture, then procrastination and other forms of what philosophers like to call weakness of the will would be downright mysterious. Downright mysterious.
Exactly. But now, do you have another picture?
Well, the phrase weakness of the will maybe suggests another picture, a kind of Humean picture. Look, this picture distinguishes between the job of reason and the job of the will. The job of reason is to figure out the best thing to do. You know, but figuring out the best thing to do isn't wanting to do it, not automatically, not ipso facto. And that's what the will has to do. The will has to make you want to do what you figured out is best to do. But, you know, unfortunately, the will doesn't always get you all the way to wanting to do this thing. That's what weakness of the will is. It's when you can't bring yourself to want to do what you figured out is what's best to do. And in procrastinators like you, that happens a lot. And in, you know, people like me, that happens too, but perhaps not as often.
Well, philosophers like you and I are pretty good at spitting out theories, but psychologists have to actually put them to the test. And when our guest Timothy Pitchell joins us in a bit, he'll help us choose between our rather half-baked ideas or more likely suggest something better.
But first, our roving philosophical reporter, Caitlin Ash, hits the streets to find the procrastinator is among us. She files this report.
Everyone procrastinates. The waitress who wants to become a student.
I'm procrastinating going back to school, you know, because of lack of funds.
The student who wants to finish school and start a career.
It's more long-term things that I'm procrastinating, which is applying for jobs or doing grad school research and stuff like that.
And the guy with three jobs already.
Like, I'm still attempting to do lots of stuff in my life when a lot of them I know might not ever be able to get done.
Yes, we all procrastinate.
I procrastinate all the time about housework. And I need to fix my brakes on my bike.
I put off doing most things, from laundry to writing papers and studying for exams. It's a mentality, really. It's a lifestyle.
I'm procrastinating a 10 by 7 foot drawing of an inverted person.
But why do we put off even the simplest tasks?
Sometimes you just don't feel like you want to do the work, and other times there are more exciting things around.
Sometimes it's because I feel like I'll do a better job later when I'm more like focused, and I never really feel that focused.
You find a lot of little things that you can do before having to complete anything else. So usually you can keep yourself busy procrastinating.
Some people are hard on themselves when they procrastinate, feel stressed, on edge, or even guilty.
Anxiety is one. I think that's like the biggest one. And that goes with the reason as to why I am procrastinating certain things and the effects of procrastinating as well. So it's kind of like this endless cycle that I'm kind of fueling and feeling the repercussions of.
Anxiety would definitely be up there, but it's exciting at the same time too to have to just kind of work really hard to come up with a solid product even though you don't have that much time left.
Still, others are relatively unfazed by procrastination and claim they prefer to work under the stress of a tight deadline.
Sometimes I actually do it on purpose because I feel like I work better under pressure, and a lot of times it does work out. When I have that pressure, then I actually do a pretty good job.
But most would agree, I might have done a better job on that paper, midterm, job application if I had just started sooner.
Once I start, the anxiety kicks in, and it's a lot of, I wish I would have started earlier. I always think I could have done a better job if I started earlier, but while I'm procrastinating, I think I'll just be really effective once I actually start. That's what I tell myself.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Caitlin Ash.
I'm John Perry, and with me is Ken Taylor.
And our guest is Timothy Pitchell. He's a professor of psychology from Carleton University. He's director of the Procrastination Research Group there and author of The Procrastinator's Digest, a concise guide to solving the procrastination puzzle. Tim, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thanks, Ken. Hi, John.
Hello, Tim. It's nice to talk to you again.
Now,
I want you to tell us briefly, how did you get interested in procrastination? Were you dealing with your own problem, or were you trying to figure out how to get the irritating procrastinators around you to mend their ways?
Neither of the above. I was studying goal pursuit and how we can understand people from their pursuit of goals. I was interviewing doctoral students, very accomplished people. I remember one student had two masters and a law degree studying for a PhD in political science, and she complained about her procrastination. So I went away from studying the goals we were pursuing successfully to studying this breakdown in volitional action that we commonly call procrastination.
Well, now, as a psychologist, you do experiments, you do studies, you do research, and you have to have a working definition, or maybe some working definitions, of procrastination. Could you share those with us?
Sure I can. I just loved your intro. I think, you know, I've been speaking to a lot of philosophers lately, but I'll tell you that all procrastination is delay, but not all delay is procrastination. It's one flavor of delay, and it has no virtue. It has no redeeming quality, and I think that's important to stress, that it's a voluntary delay of an intended action, even one, though one knows that you'll probably be worse off because of the delay. So it is this one flavor of delay that is nothing standing in the way from you working. You know you ought to be. It has that notion of acrasia that you and Ken were kind of trotting around earlier, that we know what we ought to do and we choose not to, even though we know this would probably bite us in the end. So that's the working definition.
Crazy is a fancy term for what Ken and I call weakness of the will, right?
Right, but you know, it's funny that you'd invite me on the show now, because just recently I've been talking to Mark White at City University of New York, Sarah Stroud at McGill University, Joel Anderson at University of Utrecht, all philosophers, and there's a lot of debate about whether or not we can call procrastination weakness of will in the classic sense of acrasia, or even what Holton and McIntyre call weakness of will. Although I'll tell you, I believe procrastination is weakness of will.
Okay, but I just want to focus on something you said just to underline it. So not all forms of delay, though, are procrastination. And you say you want to reserve procrastination for a kind of vicious, non-virtuous kind of delay. Here's an example of what I mean. I assume I'm writing this book on reference that I've been writing for a long time, and it's not finished because I have all these immediate demands on me, right? Mm-hmm. And it actually frustrates me that I can't spend more time on this long-term thing, because there are all these things that pop up and need addressing now. You wouldn't say I'm procrastinating writing my book, right? And what's the difference between my not being able to get my book finished, which is a lovely book, which I love writing, because I'm doing all these other things that intervene?
Well, there's a lot of shades of gray in there, but on the surface, I'd say no, if all these things are true. But, you know, humans are very good at rationalizing away cognitive dissonance, and so sometimes we make excuses for delay by being even busy with other tasks. So on the surface, though, I'd say no. If other things, more important things come up, it is just an intention update. It's delay. It's not procrastination.
When you say more important, I actually regard the book as the most important thing I work on. But, you know, the letter to the dean, the students' papers, the course to be taught, the script for philosophy talk, the baseball game I have to referee, those mm-hmm. all, I mean, does that make me a procrastinator or not? I just want to...
My vote is yes, but let's hear what Timothy says.
Well, it depends. Importance carries a lot of other connotations, including the temporal notions of urgency. So, you know, we can say it's more personally important to you to do the book. There are other things that become important because they're more, in a temporal sense, closer, and they need to be done. So I think we got to watch. We just don't define terms badly, but I don't think you're necessarily procrastinating, no.
Timothy.
In fact, I don't think some of the examples were. You know, the student interviews weren't all procrastination. Some of them were simply delay. I prefer sometimes to work later.
So before we go to break, let me give you one final challenge. You said procrastination has no redeeming value. Mm-hmm. But haven't you ever procrastinated something and then found out it was something you really didn't need to do and you were better off? Procrastination saved you from a lot of work you didn't need to do?
Yes, and when those moments happen, we hang on to them so dearly to justify every other time we want to give in to feel good. So sure, we've all been there, but it doesn't make it right.
So tell me, though, just so we get a parade example before we go to the break, what's the parade example of procrastination? No ifs, ands, or buts. Because you said some of those students who said, I work better at the last minute, that's not procrastination. But what's the parade example of procrastination?
Oh, I wouldn't say that. In fact, I've done research deliberately on that to see if there's truly something called the arousal procrastinator. We don't find evidence of that at all.
Okay, so tell me the parade
example. Giving in to feel good. I say that Sunday at 10:15, I will be working on Project X, and 10:15 comes and said, I don't feel like it, and you go and do something else instead, even though your intention hasn't changed in knowing in terms of what you ought to be doing. That's the crucial thing. That's why it goes to that old notion of acrasia that both of you were bouncing around. I know what I ought to be doing, and I'm not doing it.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today we're discussing Procrastination with Timothy Pitchell, author of The Procrastinator's Digest.
We know what procrastinators do or don't do, but why? Why do we put off until tomorrow what we should be doing today? What are the different patterns of procrastination? We'll explore that in our next segment.
Patterns of Procrastination, when Philosophy Talk continues.
Just die here and wait my turn.
Procrastinators like me often wait our turn. It's easier to wait your turn. It's easier to wait for the deadline. Actually, a little beyond the deadline before you get started on something. Rather than getting your act together and doing what's best like Ken. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. This is Philosophy Talk. Do you procrastinate? Do procrastinators drive you crazy? Has procrastination ever saved you from doing a job that turned out to be unnecessary or ill-considered?
Our guest is Timothy Pitchell from Carleton University, author of The Procrastinator's Digest.
So, Tim, we want to get into why people procrastinate in this segment. Now, John, on his website, thestructuredprocrastination.com, claims that procrastinators are often perfectionists, that they put off doing a task so at the last minute they can give themselves an excuse for doing an imperfect job. So, like, they know they're going to be imperfect or they feel they're going to be imperfect. Instead of taking it up right away and being imperfect, they wait, and then they say, see, I could have done better. Is he right about that? Is that a good hypothesis or not?
Oh, it's a good hypothesis. There's a few flavors of perfectionists identified by psychologists. One of them, maladaptive. It's socially prescribed perfectionists. So there's some people who just do a good job for themselves. Gord Flett at York University calls these self-oriented perfectionists. They don't tend to procrastinate. But if it's a socially prescribed perfectionism, you're trying to live up to other people's expectations, you don't feel you can do that, yeah, there's a tendency to put off because now what you've created is a very aversive situation. And task aversiveness, the number one reason we procrastinate. So I'm in agreement with John. Some procrastination is caused by this maladaptive form of perfectionism.
Well, what are the other basic patterns that lead to procrastination?
Well, I think if we want to talk about most people, it has to do with what Diane Tice and Ellen Braslowski has written about, giving in to feel good. We focus so much on short-term mood repair. I said a moment ago that task aversiveness is crucial, that we don't want to do the task for whatever reason. It irritates us. It's boring. And so what we do is we want to do the short-term mood repair. I'll do what I want that makes me feel good now, and then it comes back to bite us. And so across all people, that's what we're up to.
I love that phrase, short-term mood repair. That sounds like something I can use. Next time my wife says, time to empty the trash, I'll say, well, I've got some short-term mood repair that I've got to do right now.
So wait a minute. So this makes it sound like, I mean, both of you guys make it sound like we procrastinate at things that we don't really, what are the things about which over which we procrastinate? The things we don't really want to do? Onerous task? I mean, if it was a pleasant task, then would we procrastinate about it? Or is it always the onerous task that we don't really, some part of us is resisting doing this thing?
That's no doubt true. And sometimes, you know, we have, in our opening comments, we had a simple picture of reason. Reason, you look at everything you have to do, you figure out what's best. Well, what's best given what? Well, given what you value, what you have to do, what your needs are. But I think there's many levels of reason, and sometimes our unconscious reason has got different priorities than our conscious reason.
Tim, what do you think? I mean, what are the kinds of things that we're subject to procrastinate about? Is it just anything we're subject to procrastinate about?
Some of our earliest research showed that it's always things we find aversive, but we find aversive as a moving target. If it's just at the early planning stages of a project, it's the things that we find that lack personal meaning. But when it gets to the action phase of a project, the things we find aversive are things that are structured poorly, that we don't know how to do. So by and large, those are the things we procrastinate on. But there's other things in life where we say, if you listen to those interviews with a student, I'm procrastinating going back to school. And sometimes those are because they're falsely internalized goals. They're not really goals at all. They're not even your intentions. They're not you. You think you should be doing them, and it's a whole different level of ought.
Can one procrastinate out of fear at something that one really would like to do and really would be good to have done and you're fully invested? So take back to my book. Suppose I think I'm just not going to live this. I guess maybe this is the perfectionist thing. Mm. Suppose I think I just might not live up to the high standards I set myself. So I dither around out of fear. It's a kind of not unacknowledged fear of. So it's not that's not something I'm averse to. I may be averse to the failure, but I'm not averse to actually writing the book.
No, in fact, that irrational fear is something clinical psychologists focus on a lot, and then that short-term mood repair comes in again because you don't recognize it. It's quite unconscious, but you get looking at the book, and then you have these experiences of fear, and then you do something else to alleviate that, and it's very rewarding. Behaviorists at the same time would say, well, that's negative reinforcement at its best. You left the task, the fear goes away, and la-la, you're feeling better again. So certainly fear can play a role, but not for everyone. I love the work of Paul Tillich for that reason and his notion of the courage to be. I mean, that I think that in a profound way that procrastination represents an existential issue of getting on with life, and that takes courage.
Oh, I used to love Paul Tillich. I used to think I could be a Christian because I was ultimately committed to something or other. But then I found out that no one else was willing to call me a Christian just for that. But we digress. We got some insightful email from Gregory Slater. He says, procrastination can result from cognitive dissonance between how much we want to do and how much we can actually do in a given space of time. The refusal to resolve this issue makes our expectations incompatible with the time available, and that results in procrastination. How does that strike you?
Wow, it's an interesting theory. I do think we find a lot of evidence for the planning fallacy and overly optimistic bias towards thinking we can get more done in available time. But we don't usually find that that's related to procrastination. In fact, procrastinators know themselves very well. Research we've done on the planning fallacy shows they understand they're going to work later and work less. So I'm not convinced about that, but I do agree with the writer of the email in terms of cognitive dissonance. Cognitive dissonance looms large. In fact, the people who say, oh, I work better under pressure, I'll leave it till the night before. That night before, we've done research like this too, where we actually contact people. They're not spontaneously saying, I'm glad I waited till the last minute. I work so much better this way. And it was a dissonance reduction earlier in the week. So we're very good at that, and I think cognitive dissonance plays a big role in procrastination.
So even though the planning fallacy isn't the same as procrastination, a person like myself could be subject to both, right?
Absolutely. We're all subject to that to some extent, these optimistic biases, and they come into play.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about procrastination with Timothy Pitchell, one of the world's leading researchers on this topic. We've got a caller, Sheila from San Francisco. Welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Hi there. Thank you. How would the opposite of procrastination be obsessive compulsion? For instance, are there some people who just have to do this, that, and the other, and so many things?
So you're wondering, Sheila, about people who are obsessively busy. She's looking at it maybe from the procrastinator's point of view. She's saying, look, overactivity is a vice, too. What do you think about that,
and
Timothy?
I think that lots of times we want to put those two poles against one another to say that I don't want to end up that way. But you know, even Viktor Frankl, who led quite an interesting life in terms of the meaning things he wrote about, when he wrote his own autobiography, said, I do the other things first so that I have time left in my life for important things. It doesn't mean we become compulsive. It just means that we do things in a timely way so that we can actually be more spontaneous. For example, if I procrastinate a task from work and it comes into my evening now and the kids say, let's go do such and such, I say, oh, I can't, I got to work on this report. Well, in fact, what I've become is less spontaneous and less able to do things. In fact, you can even become more compulsive in some ways. A printer breaks down and it becomes a national emergency because you put things off to the last minute. So I don't think we need to put those in polar opposition.
Michael from Oakland's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Michael.
Yes, hi, thank you. Wouldn't it be possible to characterize at least some of procrastination as lingering doubts or misgivings about what you have concluded, and which would require more rational thinking, and so in some ways is actually a form of rationality rather than irrationality.
Michael, thanks for the question. I love the question. Tim, I often wonder whether procrastination doesn't get a bad name for just the reason Michael says, because sometimes the procrastination is the voice of your resisting self saying, you don't really want to do this. You judge it's best, but there's a voice inside you saying, you don't really want this, do you? I mean, what do you think about that? You said it's always you know.
Oh boy, that's a tough thing to answer quickly, because I think it gets into something like Holton and McIntyre's notion of procrastination only being a weakness of will at the implementation phase. But I think we can get things like anemic intentions, and it's at the intention formation stage that's occurring. Like you haven't even formed a strong intention or a resolution to do that what you're going to do. And I want to reserve procrastination for the individual who has made an intention, knows that they ought to do it, it's in their best interest, and then there's this intention action gap. Certainly there's going to be all sorts of potential goals and intentions in our lives that we have misgivings about, and then we want to label it with one word, procrastination, and I think that it fails for that reason.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about procrastination with Timothy Pitchell from Carleton University, author of The Procrastinator's Digest. We've got a caller, Kathy from Chicago. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, all the way from Chicago, Kathy.
Thank you.
So what's your comment or question?
Well, I was thinking, yes, I procrastinate for things I don't want to do, but I also procrastinate about things that I'm very anxious about. I want to do them. They're a real goal, but they're very important to me, and I get very anxious. You were talking about it earlier, the fear. But for me, procrastination leads, it's because of anxiety, and the only thing that will break me of that anxiety is panic. It's sort of like rock, paper, scissors of emotion. Panic trumps anxiety. So if I get to the panic stage, I'm not anxious anymore. I'm working like a fiend and getting it done.
So, Tim, what do you think? What are you going to say to Kathy here?
I think that's a beautiful description of where a lot of us do work at the last minute, in fact, but that doesn't make it a good thing. I think that you've hit, when you started, you said, yes, I have this anxiety, so let's start there. I do think that the procrastination is an emotional process, not the rational process we want to make it out to be in terms of the utility of an action or not, that if you could work on the anxiety end of things, you might be able to get into what Csikszentmihalyi calls a state of flow more voluntarily, as opposed to waiting for the trump card of panic.
But Tim, given the anxiety, isn't panic a good engineering response? You know, maybe you could go and re-engineer Kathy. Kathy, maybe you want some re-engineering. But given that she's not going to be re-engineered, isn't the panic mode a kind of rational response to that other design limitation?
It's a good response. I don't want to use the word rational, but I think it's a great response. It works. Absolutely, it works. And I think that's why I loved her rock, paper, scissors. It trumps it, and it works for her, and I think a lot of us get there. Does it make that our desired state? Not necessarily. Do I want to re-engineer her? No, but we're always in a process of becoming.
So, Kathy,
and I think that she could look for change. Yeah.
So, Kathy, how do you feel about it? Are you going to go out and re-engineer yourself, or are you going to stick with panic?
I would love to re-engineer myself. But in the meantime, I guess I'll have to use panic.
Okay, thanks for the call. John, you got some emails.
Yeah, we got some emails. Now, here's an email from Richard Gelbart. And he says, my teacher, the late great psychotherapist John Weakland, one of the founders of Strategic Theory and co-author of the Double Bind Theory, once told me the secret to life success was to have a project so important and so big you would find yourself accomplishing everything and putting it off. Now he's pointing out that this idea I have in structured procrastination isn't original in the sense that I was the first one to think about it. Probably Aristotle had it, although I don't think he was a procrastinator. But another person is Robert Benchley, the great humorist, who wrote an essay with the same idea. But now, Timothy, the next email is a question for you. And it's, is procrastination related in any way to other kind of self-destructive behavior like alcoholism and drug use?
Yes, in fact, they all get grouped together by most people who study self-regulation failure, like Roy Baumeister, Kathleen Vohs, and others, that obsessive gambling, compulsive shopping, overeating, they all share that common feature of giving in to feel good, that phrase you liked, which was short-term mood repair. They're all very much related. Now, the notion of addiction, I'm not addressing that. I'm just talking about the notion of self-regulation and how they all share that common feature. And I think, again, that goes back to that older notion of weakness of will. Even William James loved to talk about the drunkards, the schemers, and the deadbeats, because they implicitly there they were being grouped together in terms of this notion of obstructed will. Absolutely, they share a common feature of what it means to be human.
Well, this is getting better and better. So now I can say, look, I'm engaging in short-term mood repair, and most yes. people do that, drink or take drugs or gamble. So lay off the procrastination criticism.
So look, I want
to... Well, you know, it's true that it seems to be the least of the sins, although sloth, which has always been a sin, whether it be Hindu, Buddhist, Judaic, Christian, has really that it acknowledges the temporal nature of being human. Time is the most precious thing you and I have, and if we waste it, I think that's why sloth was one of the seven deadly sins.
Well, now that brings up another email, which is, isn't your guest treating procrastination as a moral issue? Is this really the right way to look at it?
Are you treating it as a moral issue?
I am. I fall directly into a camp philosophically of Mark White from the City University of New York, a Kantian economic perspective that it is an issue. As soon as I call it a weakness of will, it becomes a moral issue. And I truly believe that it is, and it is a deeply existential issue at the same time.
Let me ask another quick kind of question, though. Look, some people argue that some of these forms of irrationality that we are so criticized, we think they're forms of irrationality because we have this a priori notion of reality. Rationale. If we look at the evolved human being, we find they're actually come with adaptive advantages. Self-deception is often claimed to be adaptive. Is there any argument, evolutionary argument, that, you know, the reason we do this, mood repair kind of thing?
Short-term mood repair.
There's some adaptive advantage to that? Is there any argument on that side?
I have not seen anything written about it, but if we think about our Stone Age brain running around in the modern world, if we think about food choices, we love sugar and fat because it was so evolutionarily advantageous. But then in our modern world, we're getting obese because of it. I think the evolutionary advantage of a bird in the hand, which was often the case for perhaps our ancestors, it doesn't play itself out the same way. And so short-term mood repair comes at a greater cost, much as eating sugars and fats does now. So I do think that we do have to look at whether it's an evolutionary byproduct or an adaptation. It doesn't work so well right now.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're discussing procrastination with Timothy Pitchell, director of the Procrastination Research Group and author of The Procrastinator's Digest.
So what can be done about procrastination? Is there a Procrastinators Anonymous, a 12-step self-help program for procrastinators? Is there a Procrastinon, a program for those whose lives are being ruined by procrastinators?
Strategies for dealing with procrastination when Philosophy Talk continues.
Wait till tomorrow. Another way to say procrastinate. And procrastination is our topic today. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is Timothy Pitchell from Carleton University. So, John, I know that you've thought a lot about this. And on your website, structuredprocrastination.com, you offer some advice. Tell us, not all of your advice, but pick out the best advice you've got.
Well, the main thing, which one of our emailers pointed out, it's for procrastinators who feel bad about themselves, and it's not to solve the procrastination, although I think it's the first step towards it. And that's don't feel too bad, because at least if you're like me, you're getting a lot done as a way of not doing the task at the top of your to-do list. I mean, what led me to write it was I was feeling terrible about being such a procrastinator, and I realized, but look, all my colleagues in the philosophy department think of me as someone who gets a lot done. That could have been...
Which is true. You do get a lot done.
And how do I get a lot done? By not doing the things at the top of my to-do list. So that's structured procrastination.
But that means you do the second and third and fourth things.
Oh, and the fifth and sixth and seventh.
Right. So, Timothy, do you think that's a wise piece of advice or not? I mean, what do you think about that?
Well, I do. I think it's harnessing your avoidance motivation wherever you can get it. Use it, right? And so you're avoiding some task and it's fueling others. And that's a great strategy. But as John says, it requires a little bit of self-deception at the beginning, because what you put at the top of your list has to be apparently urgent and apparently important, but neither. And he says, tongue-in-cheek, as he said, that, well, you know, procrastinators are pretty good at this self-deception thing, so it'll usually work. But I think, sure, we can harness our avoidance motivation. Defensive pessimists do it all the time. They worry about the worst possible outcome, and they work like heck to make sure it doesn't happen. So we know, as human beings, we can harness our avoidance.
Philip in San Francisco is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Philip.
Hi, thank you. I was wondering, has Dr. Pitchell studied people who... on the opposite of folks from procrastinators, people who are like seem to have no resistance to doing the next thing? Because I'm wondering, like, because I've always read that people who are like wildly creative and make more mistakes than because they're doing more than people who are doing maybe something in the same field like art or writing or something. And they, I guess basically what I'm asking, what do people who seem to have no resistance, if you studied them, embrace or don't think about that procrastinators seem to have?
Philip's trying to figure out the difference between the folks who get it right and who are effortlessly active and successful. What's the difference between them and the procrastinators?
Well, I want to back up a little bit and say Philip's also saying that he's saying that these artists and stuff are always accurately identifying their delay as procrastination. And I think, for example, some people will be writers and they won't actually be having their fingers on the keyboard. And of course, then they feel like they're procrastinating. But in fact, there's all sorts of pre-writing work going on. So we have to watch again that we don't call every form of delay procrastination. But if I were to study the opposite of procrastinators, it would be highly conscientious people. That's one of the big five traits in personality. Conscientious people are dutiful, self-disciplined, and organized. And yes, we do see these people as being more successful in completing the next task on their list because they're structured in such a way that this notion of extended will, they're just cranking out widgets. They're not thinking about what should I do next. They know exactly what they're going to do next. It's on their schedule.
You used a phrase that I was actually thinking about, extended will, but used it in a way different from the way I was going to introduce it to you. Because here's something that I have come to think. We think of the will as a thing inside our head, and weakness of the will is weakness of the things inside our head, right? And and here's a thought that I have. But look, if we take the will inside your head, however strong or weak, engineer a set of environmental structures and incentives and all that are external to you, and that can help you not procrastinate. That's one of the things that deadlines are for. Somebody says, you must give me this paper by this or else. That's not you deciding on your own to give that paper by this time or else. It's an external thing. And it seems to me that a lot of what we need to do is engineer our volitional environment, if you will. What do you think about that thought?
Well, Joe Heath and Joel Anderson, University of Utrecht, wrote a chapter in the recent book, The Thief of Time, Philosophical Essays on Procrastination, arguing just that. And I'm in total agreement that this notion of extended will, that the social context can scaffold our ability to do things, much like I don't do calculated, very complicated math calculations in my head. I use a piece of paper. I have a tool. And we can do that to structure our will as well. But in contrast to that, Mark White would argue, but the more we rely on these prosthetics and tools, we can do it to our own detriment in that we can weaken this willpower that's like a muscle. Roy Baumeister's students have shown that.
Yeah, I'm dubious
about that. So we have this tension. We have this tension. It is internal and it is external. The opposite of one great truth is often another great truth, and I think this is a classic example.
You know, when I was younger, I trained myself to wake up without an alarm clock by just thinking about waking up at a certain time. And I was very proud of that, but actually, what was the big deal? So now I just use an alarm clock. And alarm clocks can be used for lots of things. When you start on your email, put the alarm clock for an hour later because you won't stop on your own. But when you hear that alarm clock, it'll break your attention, and then you'll have the power to stop. But I see nothing wrong with will prosthetics.
I agree with you, John, but I think I think we live in a really complicated world. We've done a show on the extended mind, how we offload a lot of our cognition onto the environment, and that modern technology enables us to do that with a vengeance, so that, you know, the internet and all that, all these external memory aids and processing aids. But here's the problem with the modern world, that a lot of this stuff that we use to offload our cognition makes the will much weaker because you've got all these distractions, right? The will needs to be focused. And
that is the argument. And the other thing, too, is that we all know this, that I can set my alarm, and when my alarm goes off, I still have an issue of that internal self-control of actually getting out of bed. Like we never can sidestep the at some point I have to exert what you internalized as will. No matter what prosthetics or tools or however scaffolding I do it, there's at one point you can't sidestep this notion of self. Although behavioral economists like to deny the sense of human agency because it's so deterministic. I think in fact we always come back to the issue of me recognizing my sense of agency and acting.
That's true. But let me give you an analogy. I got a bunch of sand, bags of sand to take from one place to the other. And I could say, well, I'm not very strong, but I'm going to build up my strength by carrying them myself. Or I could say, I'm
going
to put them in a wheelbarrow. Now, it still takes some will to pick up the wheelbarrow, and it takes some strength to pick up the wheelbarrow. But why not make it easier on yourself?
And you should. And I totally agree with you.
So I'm just, you know, I'm all for what a prosthetics of the will. We've got an email that's a little bit challenging here I want to put in here. It's from James Decker, and he says, the problem with you guys is you sound like a motivational advertisement. He doesn't think we're being philosophical enough. Then skipping over to the subject, he says, I challenge you to leave off the predictable fallacy that reason equals logic or pleasure equals good as the basis for every behavior. What about dwelling in a state of pure human free will? In fact, malaise is the human condition. Oh, art and meditation express precisely this. Please speak instead of the long history of human free will as expressed through, for example, the somebody of Oscar Wilde's day who would walk turtles on leashes in the expression of liberation.
Oh, that's
utilitarian philosophy. Well, he's got a point. Is our whole approach just kind of giving into the system?
No, it's baloney, what he was saying. Because here's the philosophically deep point that's a lot different from motivational advertising. Look, it goes back to something Tim said in passing that I think is really important here, the self. Right, because here's an important fact about the self. It's not an instantaneous thing. It's spread out over time, right? Mm-hmm. But our interests, the interest of this self, kind of rise and fall with time. And one of the things I think about procrastination is that when you're procrastinating in a moment, you're being, here's a kind of moral thing, you're being unfair to your future self because your present self isn't doing its task in bringing about the good for this whole extended thing that you are. I don't think that's motivational advertising. I think that's deep fact about the structure of human agency.
Now, before Timothy responds to that, let me just interject with one more email and says, does the guest know about the work on intertemporal bargaining and the idea of hyperbolic discounting?
Yeah, I know you do, Tim. So what do you want to respond to in what we just said?
Well, hyperbolic discounting is a good, as Joe Heath writes, it models procrastination while it doesn't explain it. And I think that we've got to do a lot of work around the difference between the behavioral economic models and how they put value over the visceral. Even Ainsley writes about this. And in fact, we're working on a paper right
that.
Now.
Okay, yeah. Explain that, value over the visceral. Well, that's an important...
First of all, one of you explain what's meant by hyperbolic reasoning.
Yeah, hyperbolic discounting. Explain
hyperbolic
that.
Discounting.
First, explain that.
We discount future rewards. We talk about the fact that what's in the distant is smaller, and that what is in the present is in proportionately more important and larger, and it's a balancing off of the utility. They look at doing that which has the greatest utility right now. So it involves these features. Like, it's a difficult thing to explain in about the 30 seconds.
So look, if there's something that I were to be able to get now, I would enjoy it a certain amount, right? It would give me a certain amount of utiles. But the fact that I can't get it until the future makes it less valuable in my present calculations than it would be if I could get it right at this moment. That means I'll take a reward now over a reward later, where the reward later would be more valuable once I got it, but it's less valuable. Is that kind of?
Exactly. Yeah. That's right.
And is that a bad thing or a good thing?
It's a human thing. We do discount these things. We prefer the sooner, smaller reward over the longer, larger reward. But it doesn't explain procrastination very well. It does explain delay. It's a very rational thing. Like, why not? But it doesn't explain everything that we need to know about the phenomenon of procrastination.
Do you think I'm right to say that if you're procrastinating, your present self is cheating your future self? Is that reasonable?
Absolutely. In fact, I've just written blogs on all of these topics, including extended will and the future self on Psychology Today. I have a blog called Don't Delay. It's available at procrastination.ca, and I'd welcome readers to look at it because they are the philosophical debates going on in that great book, The Thief of Time.
So procrastination.ca, that's your blog, and I'm sure...
That's my website, and everything's available there,
okay,
including my iTunes podcast.
Oh, so tell us about your iTunes. What do you podcast about on iTunes?
Oh, I have a podcast called I Procrastinate Podcast. I've done it since 2005, and it's really all the kind of things we're talking about week after week after week.
Man, you're a procrastinator. You're the god of procrastination. You were exactly the right guest for us to get for this show.
Can you give us and our listeners a couple of tips on overcoming procrastination before we have to say goodbye?
Yeah, really quickly. Your one-minute advice here.
One is I kind of agree with Mark White, which is just try harder, which is that internal notion of will. But for me, it's just get started. You know, the journey of 1,000 miles begins with that single step. And we even heard it in the students you interviewed at the outset of this program, that once they get started, they wonder, why didn't I start earlier? It's not so bad. We know that for a fact. The other is, have an implementation intention. A weekly held goal intention about what you want to accomplish is not nearly as effective as what Peter Galwitzer calls an implementation intention. if the situation is this, then I do that. I put the signal, the trigger for my behavior, it has to do with the notion of extended will in some ways. I put a trigger for my action in the environment, and it helps break habits because I've made a pre-decision to act. It's much like using the alarm clock in a sense. I no longer have to think. I've made a pre-decision to act. It'll make a big difference to use implementation intentions.
So on that note, Mark, I'm going to thank you. Tim, I'm going to thank you for joining us. You just mentioned somebody named Mark. Tim, I'm going to thank you for joining us. It's been a really proactive conversation, and we've really loved having you.
I've enjoyed being with you. Thank you.
Our guest has been Timothy Pitchell. He's the director of the Procrastination Research Group at Carleton University. He's the author of The Procrastinator's Digest, a concise guide to solving the procrastination puzzle. And you can find out a lot more at his website, procrastination.ca. So, John, I know you've thought a lot about this topic. Did this conversation change your thinking, deepen your thinking in any way?
Well, Timothy Pitchell is terrific. I was a co-guest on a radio show with him once before and found out that he not only writes well, he's really a terrific radio guest. However, deep in my heart, I don't think he knows procrastination from the inside in the way that I do. He sounds like an accomplisher. I bet his desk is not a mess either. I'm not sure.
Well, you think you have to live procrastination in order to research procrastination?
He's
looking at all those procrastinators as strange subjects.
You don't have to be an ant to learn a lot about ants. I'm just saying that it is an additional dimension bring to the problem.
I can't decide about myself whether I'm a procrastinator or not, because I'm definitely overcommitted.
Well, you don't need to decide right away.
And the structure of my commitments sometimes prevents me from getting the larger things that I want done. But then I say that's something I did to myself. But you know what? This conversation, and that may be procrastination, making yourself overcommitted. This conversation continues on our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is cogito ergo blogo. I think, therefore, I blog. And you can find out more about us by visiting a very, very active Facebook page where we have thousands and thousands of fans and more coming every single day.
And you can sign up to get the free weekly podcast of Philosophy Talk at our website, philosophytalk.org. Don't procrastinate. Get on your computer and do that right away. For the final word, we're going to give a few seconds more for Ian Scholes, the 60-second procrastinating philosopher.
Ian Scholes' decisiveness is a two-edged sword. Fortune favors the brave, and yet fools rush in. If you act boldly, are you brave or a fool? Life-altering decisions, if my life is any indication, never alter life the way you think they will. Take Custer. If he'd procrastinated, he might have decided maybe it's not a good idea to track a few thousand angry Indians with a force less than 200. Or take the Alamo. If the defenders of the Alamo had been proactive, they might have decided, you know what, Texas isn't worth the aggro. Let's just surrender. We're encouraged to be proactive rather than reactive, but we're only human. Why pay fire insurance for something that might not even happen? Where's the fun in that? It's so much more fun to watch brave firefighters dash in and out of the flames. Remember Goofus and Gallant from the old Highlights magazine? Used to read it in the dentist's office where I'd end up with a cavity or two because I'd procrastinated on my checkup. Gallant always did everything right, wound up getting the job done. Goofus always took the easy way out and wound up messing things up. I found Gallant to be an insufferable prig and identified heavily with Goofus. Plus, it seemed to me in the real world, Goofus is the one that actually succeeds in life. Say a teacher assigns an essay due at the end of the semester. Gallant will be proactive and diligent, writing the essay in a week and turning it in months ahead of time. What's the teacher going to think? Oh, thanks, little responsible butt-kisser. Now I have to lug this essay around for 2 months. There's already resentment and a prejudice against Gallant. How good can this essay be if it only took a week to write it? Goofus, however, will dash into class with his essay a day after it was due, haggard, out of breath, dropping on the teacher's desk before collapsing on the floor. Goofus will have put much less work into his essay, but will have presented the illusion that he sweat, blood, and brain cells writing it. Teachers like that. Plus, the longer it takes a student to turn in a paper, the longer teachers can put off grading it. Win-win. Proactivity actually leads to procrastination. If you want to fireproof your office building, say, you need to figure out where to get permits. You want to get the best contractor. That means research, committees, feasibility studies, lawyers, PowerPoint demonstrations. How will this impact your employees? You need feedback from them, and they'll use the opportunity to air grudges and grievances that have nothing to do with the project. This can take years. In the meantime, some disgruntled employee will torch the building, and you'll wind up in the parking lot watching the brave firefighters dash in and out of the flames. So it just goes to show you, trying to make money is a bad idea. That's why I procrastinated for years in pursuing a fabulous show business career. Luckily today, I'm in public radio, and I'm wealthy beyond an emperor's dreams. Put it off. It'll all work out. I gotta go.
The Wisdom of the Ages, in a nutshell, from Ian Scholes, the 60-Second Philosopher.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2011.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
Our production coordinator is Devin Strolovich. Our directors of research are Daniel Elstein and Ben Hirsch. Leah Weiss is our webmaster.
And special thanks to Chris Hoff, Merle Kessler, Corey Goldman, Dave Millar, and Mark Stone.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University. The Friends of Philosophy Talk,
and the members of KALW San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.